Welcome to the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota. This is Arts and Cultural Heritage producer Jeff Carmack, and in today's installment, it's all about the untold story of baseball in Central Minnesota. More specifically, it's about one particular player in the early days of baseball who had a surprising and a long-standing effect on the game as we know it today. His name was John Donaldson. He was born in 1891 and passed away in 1970. He was an African-American pitcher in the pre-Negro Leagues and the Negro Leagues, and then became a Major League scout, specializing in networking with African-American players during a time in our country when the introduction of African-Americans into baseball was controversial. John Donaldson had deep roots in Minnesota all during his career, and through some surprising twists, we know much more about John Donaldson than we do about many of the other players during this era, simply because of some technological and cultural quirks of Minnesota. And that's what we're going to get into today as we talk with my guest on the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota, freelance writer and journalist Pete Gorton. So welcome to the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota, Pete. Why don't you just let us know a little bit about yourself and, well, how long have you been researching John Donaldson?
I'm Pete Gorton, and I live in Northeast Minneapolis with my wife and two kids, and I've been researching baseball and John Donaldson, black baseball players, for about 15 years. Started the Donaldson Network in about 2006. John Donaldson played in over 25 states, and so I was traveling around at the time as a freelance journalist, and I was running all over the United States picking up John Donaldson stories, and then I realized that I needed to start asking people for help. Mm-hmm. And with the dawn of everyday email and listservs and genealogy, online genealogy, you can go find anybody who you used to be related to or still are. There's people out there who could go to their small town and pull up newspaper stories. And so I would contact them, put them on the list, tell them exactly what we were looking for. I need you to go find me a game that happened on June 12th, 1914, and it happened in your small town in Nebraska. Could you go there, please? Well, yeah, I walk by the courthouse every day on my way to coffee. I can stop in there and photocopy or transcribe an article for you and send it to you. And so I started doing that, and I posted a lot on Ancestry. Early on Ancestry and Ancestry.com, and then my mailbox started filling up.
Yeah, word started spreading. There's somebody looking for stuff.
Right. And so I could send things to complete strangers who knew their town better than I did and ever would. And so it was an opportunity technologically changed and allowed us to be able to contact these people, give them background information, and we're somewhere around 2,000 games that have been submitted or found or uncovered, however you want to say it, which equates to about 397 wins for John Donaldson now, right around 5,000 strikeouts, which makes him the greatest black baseball pitcher of all time in terms of number of wins and number of strikeouts, in terms of the golden numbers of baseball, which are 300 wins for pitchers. 5,000 strikeouts is a lot. And he was playing in segregated time, and that was the only place that he could play.
Yeah, now we say 100 years ago, but it's actually closer to like 130 now that I'm doing the math in my head. And we were talking about like kind of the origins of the Negro League. And you say it's kind of like the mist of history back then. We're not really sure when it started, but we've got, well, why don't you explain that this unique historical thing about Minnesota, which allowed you to find some of these records that you weren't able to find in other states?
Well, In 1910, a guy named Edward Backus, who's famous in the upper, in northern Minnesota, was a lumber baron. He built the world's most technologically advanced paper mill in International Falls right around 1910. And so what he was doing was he was harvesting the northern woods, taking all the logs, and there's many photographs, and it's well-documented history of moving the northern woods in making paper out of it. And so what we had was very solid paper stock. And so you would get to places that were not too far away in modern parlance, North Dakota, South Dakota, five-state area, really. And they had ample supply of quality newspaper. And so opinions could be written in small towns. They could have two and three newspapers. And so to fill up the newspapers, they talked about almost anything. And so when John Donaldson or other great black ball players of that era would come to town, it was always written down because there was multiple voices. And so the ability to have newsprint that was would stand the test of time, get to the bicentennial in 1976 when they made it a state law to microfilm all the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
So they brought all their newspaper in. It survived that long because it was quality paper. And that is a unknown part of history that makes the story deeply and uniquely ours, because that's what survives. I've been to state historical societies all over the United States looking for John Donaldson games, and they're just not there because the paper didn't survive. And the state historical society, for one reason or another, in some states had fires, some states had natural disasters, that flooding that's ruined all their newspapers. I mean, there are things like that, natural disasters that naturally would happen.
Yep.
But we had newsprint that was solid and could hold up to the bicentennial microfilm process that they did in the mid-1970s.
Nice. So, why don't you break it down once again, just how these ballplayers kind of came through the various towns?
Well, depending on when the color line was drawn in Major League Baseball, there wasn't a minor league system in the late 1800s. There was no go to AAA for a couple of weeks and then come up to the major league club. That stuff didn't really start until the mid-1920s, when the St. Louis Cardinals decided they were going to have minor league affiliates, and then everybody else decided they needed the same thing, where they could get ballplayers who would season themselves before they'd get to the major league team. And so there wasn't a whole web of different ball clubs that all had the same affiliation the way it is now. And so the ballplayers that were, when they drew the color line, when they decided that African Americans could not play in organized baseball, there was a whole bunch of ballplayers, great ballplayers, who had nothing to do. And this is all they did. It wasn't like they had a side job and did something else. They went straight to where the money was, straight to where they could get the free agent sort of model of wherever they'd pay me, I'm going. And so they dispersed far and wide across the Midwest, particularly, because there was money there. And they were major league ballplayers. And one of the things that I like to talk about is Negro League ballplayers, the great Negro League ballplayers, were guaranteed major leaguers. If everything was equal today, back then, they would be on the same stage as any of the white players, any of the international players. Negro League ballplayers, the cream of the crop, would have been top-line major leaguers. And so we were robbed of somewhere around 60 to 80 years of developing these players. They played and they were great. And skilled positions, particularly pitchers, catchers, they played every position they could play. But particularly the African-American ball players they still played. And they could make a living if they were good enough. But they had to deliver. And so there was still that, we're not going to bring you all the way to Little Falls to be a 500 team. In Little Falls, they had a guy named Webster McDonald in the late 1920s, who was put there by John Donaldson, who had pitched in Bertha in the early 1920s. So they came to John Donaldson and said, we need a black starting pitcher. Can you find us one? Yes, I know a bunch of guys. So he sent his friends up to here, and he littered central Minnesota with some of the greatest black ball players of all time. Played very near St. Cloud for teams all over because John Donaldson placed him there.
Yeah, a very different world, but yet at the same time, a very similar world. It's like, let's bring in a superstar athlete and, get like 5,000 people to show up for a game. And, hey, everybody pays a ticket and we made some money.
Right.
Let's do it
again. Oftentimes, the black ball players would come in late in the season and pitch one or two games. That happened a lot around here. John Donaldson was asked to go to Cambridge, and he'd go to Albany, and he'd go to different places that they just wanted to pitch for one game, and then they'd advertise that game. Their team would be in the red the whole season. They'd lose money the whole season, but they'd make all their money back in one game because all these crowd would come to see the black ball players play, and then they'd invite them back to play again next year to try and balance their ledger.
Mm.
And so that was a key part of the showmanship part of the game. I mean, you had to have a reputation, then you had to deliver on that reputation, and one of the great stories about John Donaldson is that he constantly did that, and he did that for almost 35 years and thousands of games.
Yeah, that's 35 years. That's kind of incredible.
A long time.
Yeah.
Right. And it could be more. We're still finding more and more on its early years. We're finding more and more in the later mid-1930s, early 1940s. But John Donaldson played for 35 years. Then he became the first black scout in Major League Baseball history for the Chicago White Sox, and that was in 1949, 3 years after Jackie Robinson. So you would have 3 years after Jackie Robinson signed with the Brooklyn Dodgers, but played in Montreal for a season, didn't come up until 1947. And so that was important at that time because he was the first African-American to be employed by a major league team as a scout as we know it today. There were lots of people who were recommending lots of players, but he was officially the first black scout in Major League Baseball history. And he has, and then what he did was, what's so great about it was he started placing black ball players all over the state of Minnesota who were trying to get into the minor league system for the Chicago White Sox. And so John Donaldson's fingerprint, if you want to talk about historic black baseball players and the whole genre, John Donaldson's in the beginning, he's in the middle, and he's in the end. Because the end of organized Negro leagues after Jackie Robinson, about 15 years, they folded up because the great players were moving to the major leagues, and all of them did. Henry Aaron and Willie Mays and Ernie Banks, and the list goes on and on and on of the great would-have-been Negro League players were now in the major leagues, and so the draw was not as effective as it was in the black community at that time, and so they folded, and they just couldn't make money with the Negro League teams.
Well, it's
so
it's John a changing Donaldson, environment, yeah,
yeah. Yeah, so John Donaldson covers the whole thing. Walter Ball, Webster McDonald, Chester Brewer, dozens of great black ball players played all over the state of Minnesota for little towns because that's where they had to go. But if you want to talk about the whole pantheon of how the whole history of black baseball, John Donaldson's in the beginning, the middle, and he is the end. And his historical significance is and needs to be rebuilt, and that's what we're trying to do.
You're in tune to 88.1 FM KVSC and the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota. Today we're talking with Peter Gorton about the African-American baseball player John Donaldson, as well as many others from that era, and how they had a significant impact on small towns in Minnesota where they played. So the project that you're working on and you know, this book that is that you're coming into town for the Granite City Book Club, why don't you tell us a little bit about how that got started and what is that?
A history professor at Minnesota State Moorhead named Stephen Hoffbeck was my high school social studies teacher at Staples High School. He ran into my mom at the post office in Staples, and they started talking about me, and I was working in Florida at the time, so he sent me a picture of Bobby Marshall, who was a great African-American football player at the University of Minnesota, who also played for the St. Paul Colored Gophers. He was putting together a chronological history of black baseball players in our state. What he was trying to do was kind of a decade at a time, trying to find one personality that personified that decade. And so he started in the 1870s and came all the way through. Kirby Puckett was in the book as well. So black ball players that played here. And so he had a particular gap between 1910 and 1930. And the greatest black baseball player between 1910 and 1930 to play in the state of Minnesota was John Donaldson. He shopped the story around to a couple of history friends of his, writers that he thought would take on the story, and they said they didn't want to do that. The history of John Donaldson was too hard to figure out, and so they didn't want to do that. And so he said, would you give me anything on John Donaldson that you can find? You're from Staples. A great part of John Donaldson's history is in Bertha, Minnesota, which is 13 miles away. The people in Bertha knew who I was. They knew that I wasn't just somebody walking off the street wanting to know about John Donaldson. And so I had the opportunity to have the kind of backstage access for all these people who have been keeping the John Donaldson history for so many years, and they knew I was from here. And that was a key because we could build relationships with people. And the Donaldson Network's really about building relationships with people to be able to piece this whole thing back together. And so, and then in the meantime, the World Wide Web comes around, and now I can start posting things, and I have my website guy. He lives in Australia, and he puts up all these the history of all these games, thousands of games that we have for this guy. We put them all up there. My point is that we put together a network of people who could tell the story from their perspective. So it really isn't my job to tell you what, how important John Donaldson was in Melrose, Minnesota, but the guy in Melrose knows, and the guy in Melrose knows that story too, and he was willing to tell me about that and show me everything he had on that, and now I have a champion in Melrose. So whenever somebody comes in with a box of photographs that from one of their ancestors that they just don't know what to do with, here, Melrose Historical Society, here's my family photographs, you can have these, and there's a picture of a black ball player in there, he's going to call me. And that's what needs to happen, and that's what we recognized early on, was this story was so scattered, and so many of the truths and what were taken as facts weren't actually the fact. It was just what somebody went with because they had to go with something. And so we had a real problem with trying to differentiate the historical lore legend of these guys and trying to make it facts. So I started cobbling together all these game room counts of people who had come before, and they called me and they said, Pete, we found John Donaldson's unmarked grave in Chicago. Would you come down for the service? Okay. The Chicago White Sox bought a headstone for him, and they put a nice copper headstone on his grave, and that was in 2004. John Donaldson died in 1970, mm-hmm. about 3 or 4 months after I was born. And so I had really no way of knowing him ever, but they knew that I was doing John Donaldson research, so they invited me down there. And I thought I'd go down there, and we'd huddle around the grave, and there'd be a bunch of guys who knew a lot of stuff about him. And so I looked to my right, and it's the head of Sabre Negro Leagues Committee, and he's standing there. And I said to him, they were singing the national anthem, and I whispered in his ear, does anybody really know anything about this guy? And he said, no, not really. Do you want to? And so we decided that day, that was the time, that we were going to figure out who John Donaldson was, what his historical value was, what his historical significance was to the game, and then we were going to let you decide what that was, because we aren't going to tell you, because lots of people give you their opinions, and I don't want to give you my opinion on it. I will tell you, he was one of the greatest of all time. His numbers show that. His numbers prove that.
Well, then there's anecdotes, too. You were telling me, we were talking about Lindbergh a little bit before we got to talking. Why don't you tell that story?
Yeah, in 1927, Charles Lindbergh had a homecoming celebration after he made the first transatlantic flight to Paris.
Mm-hmm.
And he was from Little Falls, and they wanted to have a baseball game. Because baseball was the social activity at the time. Movie theaters were new. As a matter of fact, hundreds of times they predicted baseball is dead because the movies, people all want to go inside to the movies, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so it was the social activity. So on Sundays, everywhere in every small town, everywhere in the state of Minnesota, there was a ball game going on, and people would all go watch them, right? This is where they got their interaction with their neighbors.
This is their social media.
Right. Their social activity was to come to church on Sunday, go to the ball game afterwards, meet all the people who are their neighbors and townspeople, and pass stories back and forth. And there's great photographs all throughout the state of Minnesota of people gathering on Sundays. Well, this was a money-making opportunity. Anyway, Charles Lindbergh came back. There was 50,000 people in Little Falls celebrating Minnesota's native son who did the most heroic thing. They all came back. There was a baseball game associated with that. John Donaldson pitched that day. So did Dave Brown, who was a great Negro League player who was exiled in Minnesota after a murder plot in New York City when he played for the Brooklyn franchise. He allegedly murdered somebody, and he fled to Minnesota. And he knew John Donaldson, so John Donaldson put him in a place called Wanda, Minnesota, which is in southwestern Minnesota, in 1926. Dave Brown, relatively famous black baseball player at that time, on the run, shows up in small town Wanda, Minnesota, which is a mere 30, 40 miles from Lismore, where John Donaldson is. It's not an accident. John Donaldson knew the people. He knew the landscape here. So Dave Brown, John Donaldson pitched in a game against the House of David, which is a traveling baseball team for the Lindbergh celebration, because they needed to entertain people. And everybody knew that John Donaldson was a huge drawing card at that time. He happened to pitch 2 days before in a big game in Bemidji, which was a big money-making game, so he was limited in the mound time that he had that day, so they brought in Dave Brown to pitch right after him. So you had two left-handed pitchers, two of the greatest left-handed pitchers in Negro League history, taking the mound in Little Falls on the day Charles Lindbergh came back to be the heroic native son. And the image there, or the idea of the spirit of St. Louis coming up over the horizon, to the throng of people gathered for the baseball game to look up and have John Donaldson be on the mound and see Charles Lindbergh fly over in the solo airplane is an image that has stuck with me since the day I started this and continues with me today, because in 1927, when the single engine airplane flew over, everybody looked, and it was a matter of making people look, and that's still the same. They were trying to find as many people to watch the games as they could find, and Charles Lindbergh celebration was one of those big opportunities for Dave Brown and John Donaldson to be able to show that they were great ball players.
Nice. So once again, the website, how would people get a hold of you if they wanted more information or have more information?
Sure. johndonaldson.bravehost.com is our webpage. Like I said, my website guy lives in Australia, which is a technological marvel. When you start to think about the things we're studying, we're all very microcosm, very small, very in very locales. To be able to have my website guy live in Australia and take care of all this stuff virtually across the planet is a feat in itself. But johndonaldson.bravehost.com is our web address. If you just Google search John Donaldson Minnesota Baseball, it comes up. We have email addresses there, mailing addresses there to be able to tell us his stories. And a lot of them we have, but a lot of them we don't have. I'm never naive enough to say that we have everything. There's no way. The stuff just comes out slowly, and building relationships with people, that's the key.
Nice. Well, anything else you'd like to throw out there?
John Donaldson wasn't alone. There were many great black teams, individual black baseball players who played in the state of Minnesota in the early 1900s. He wasn't like he was the first black player here. It wasn't like he was... He was handed the baton. They were one after another. The guys would come here and they'd play in different places, various places. These guys would take the money and leave. And they'd get ball players, black and white, from the Twin Cities, and they'd come up to St. Cloud and play just on Sundays, and then they'd take their money out of their communities. And so semi-professional baseball started to suffer in the late 1920s because small towns realized we can't have outsiders come here and take our money and leave town. They'd rather have you spend it there. That hasn't changed in 100 years. And it happens today. And so the black ball players, the semi-professional nature started to erode. And you started to get a lot more amateur teams. The state amateur tournament started in 1926, and Dave Brown was one of the first black players for WANDA. They lost to a team from Minneapolis at the state fairgrounds in 1926. Amateur baseball really got going in early 1930s, late 1920s, as a response to semi-professional baseball, which was take the money out of town, and they wanted everybody to stay there. So they made up all kinds of rules, like you had to have a job there, you had to work there, you had to own a house there, whatever. They made all kinds of rules that made you be local, which continue today. Small town team baseball has rules about where players can live. You can't just bring in anybody from anywhere. And that in different leagues have different things, obviously. But my point is that continues today. They're not being paid in town team baseball these days. It's all amateur. But that idea hadn't happened until after the late 1920s, when semi-professional baseball kind of got a sour note because people wanted locals to play on their teams rather than have hired out. So that real heyday of semi-professional hired out, hired gun guys coming in to play for your team was really in the 1920s, when it was really wide open and there was money for that. And John Donaldson could make hundreds and hundreds of dollars a month, more money than they could make in the organized Negro League, which started in 1920. And he left the Kansas City Monarchs, the most storied franchise in Negro League baseball history, to play in Bertha, Minnesota, because he could make more money here. And that was different. And he didn't have to travel so much. He could stay in Bertha. He had a house in Bertha. He could stay in the Twin Cities where his wife was from. And it was closer to family. So he had a lot of intrinsic reasons to be in Minnesota, not hang out in Kansas City and play in the Negro League. He made a lot more money here. And he sustained his legacy for himself just by holding a job, staying in Minnesota, rather than go to the Negro League, where he wasn't losing a step. He was playing the outfield for the Kansas City Monarchs and hitting 300. And very successful Kansas City teams, but eventually they started losing money, and he went back out on the road and supplemented the Kansas City Monarchs coffers by playing for a team called the All Nations, and traveled all over the state of Minnesota again, because it was sort of a minor league system where he could take some fresh black players who were wanting to play for the Monarchs, and they could season them out here playing in almost nowhere for money and season the ball players. So John Donaldson took his team back on the road in 1922 and 1923 when the Negro League was going on, but didn't have to be there because he could make more money on the road, which he did. And then he finally settled in Bertha for 24, 25, and 27 with a stint in Lismore, Minnesota in 1926. And then he came to St. Cloud in 1930, midst of the Depression. They hired him on, he had to win in order to get paid. And so, and they were very successful. They didn't hire him as a contract. There wasn't contracts like there are now. He came to St. Cloud, played with a bunch of semi-professional, ex-semi-professional guys in St. Cloud, had a very, and their main rival was Little Falls, and they had Webster McDonald as their pitcher. And so they're great, great storylines and great newspaper articles, both from Little Falls and here, that chronicle these games between some of the greatest black ball players that there ever were.
It's an amazing history, and it's recorded. So right. that's the beautiful thing,
but
too.
But, Jeffrey, the key is the color line. If this isn't drawn, these guys don't come here. And so the opportunity for them to play wouldn't have been here had the color line not been drawn in the late 1800s. And so the opportunity for them was here, the opportunity to lay their roots down and become household names in the state of Minnesota was there only because they were completely excluded from Major League Baseball or organized baseball at that time. And so the key to the story is the color line and how that propagated itself and what happened to these guys because
And that existed for 60 years, too.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And 60 years they decided that black players couldn't play. Mm-hmm. And there was even time when they thought that black players and white players couldn't coexist on a team together. There's newspaper articles written about the All Nations team, which was an amalgamation of people from different nationalities, different races, and they played on, they squished them all together and put them on a train car and traveled them around because that was a sideshow. They wanted to see the immigrant population that was the upper Midwest wanted to see players of similar nationalities to them. And they always wanted to see major leaguers. And the key to the story is Negro League, great Negro League players would have been major league players. There's no question about that. And so all things being equal, if we did that, they would have, people came out to see major league baseball players that they couldn't see anywhere else, and they just happened to be in their hometown. Mm-hmm. And so people came out in droves to see major league caliber players dominate even their local teams because they wanted to see major leagues. You just couldn't go to Chicago to see the closest major league franchise. The Minneapolis Millers and the Saints had minor league teams in those times, American Association teams, but they didn't have major leaguers. Mm-hmm. And so the black players were looked at as, these are major leaguers, we know that, we're going out to see them and we'll pay for that. And that's the key to their story, was the color line made them come here. They were major leaguers and they were some of the greatest players of all time. And they played right in our neighborhoods, and the historical sites that are still littered across the state of Minnesota. John Donaldson played in over 130 cities in Minnesota. The places where he played are still accessible to people today, and that's what's really enriching about the history. And when John Donaldson and his teams came to town, that was the big show, and everybody came to see that. And so it was a money-making opportunity. It was opportunity for him to lay down a legacy we're still trying to piece back together.
Well, Peter Gorton, thanks for stopping in today and talking baseball.
Yeah, Jeffrey, I appreciate it.
And we've been talking with Peter Gorton today on the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota. Peter's going to be in town on July 29th to hang out with the Granite City Book Club as they celebrate Minnesota baseball. The afternoon begins with the St. Cloud Rocks taking on the Mankato Moondogs at 12:05 p.m. And then the book club will meet at the Good Earth Food Co-op at 6 p.m. to discuss the book Swinging for the Fences, Black Baseball in Minnesota. For links to the Granite City Book Club events, as well as the Donaldson Network, you can find links on our website at kvsc.org under the Podcasts and Untold Stories of Central Minnesota link for this story. This has been Arts and Cultural Heritage producer Jeff Carmack, and the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota is made possible through support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and has been produced at KVSC, a proud member of Amper's Diverse Radio for Minnesota's communities.